Israelis are now buying up property all over southern Cyprus, and they're locking the Greeks out, by the way, that the native population. And they also made a demand that the Greeks start rent to own Aegean islands to them. Oh yeah, these people, they don't have any kind of, rent us out these islands and we'll eventually buy them from you.
Settlements, like it'll be settlements, yeah, settlements in Greece. I mean, why not? It's just they have a lot of faith in the Holy Land, clearly.
Oh yeah, well yeah. There's 300,000 are going to be building a new colony in Argentina. Did you hear
I
about
mean,
that?
why? What are they hedging for there? I can't imagine. Are they down in southern Argentina? Are they Bariloche?
They are. There was a law
Think.
that was passed that any damaged natural reserves or fire damage could be sold to foreigners. And then there's a lot of videos coming out of people setting fire to the
Yeah, that
forest
was
in
a
the mountains.
big controversy before. Yeah.
And
You
now
know,
apparently they're going to have a 300,000 man colony there.
I think it's in the south, and you know, coincidentally, Bariloche and these areas were settled by another wave of immigrants after the Second World War. The ones that had, with the pink swastikas on their socks, those guys, they went down to the same place. It's so funny how history rhymes.
It is, isn't it? The first time history rhymes. Well, the first time history repeats is a tragedy. The second time, it's a farce. So, yeah, it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing to watch this, the way it's unfolding. But and then again, we'd started talking about the Trump crime syndicate, and people go, "Oh, derangement syndrome." Yeah, but when you steal Venezuelan oil using the U.S. military. Half of it's supposed to go to back to Venezuela somehow or other, but in theory anyways, and the rest goes to an offshore non-transparent slush fund. How does that work again?
Well, remember when they were explaining this, when Rubio was saying, no, we're going to take their oil and then sell it at market value. I remember very clearly that was the sales pitch. But you know, the way he explained it was like, well, we're going to sell it for them and then you'll give them all the money. And I'm thinking to myself, because in order for them to help the Venezuelan people, I said, why didn't you just lift sanctions then? You know, let them sell it on the market at market value. Like, what's the difference? So they weren't being straight. And there is a lot of theft and embezzlement going on to selected people who are given opportunities, not just no-bid contracts, but like opportunities to be involved in handling, facilitating certain things. The reason Trump is absolutely livid about the Straits of Hormuz is when he really started going postal on that was when Iran started charging. Okay, that's when Trump, that's when his alarm goes off. So, 'cause he's like, I want that money. They're like daily metered traffic through the, I want that money. Like, how dare they? That's ours. You know, that's our money. That's
What's
the
mine is mine, and
mentality.
what's yours is also.
That's the mentality, you know. That's what he was really upset about. And so, and of course, whatever his Israeli coterie is, they would want to position themselves either or his sons or Jared or whoever would cough through, and they will stable coin it. They'll stable coin it. And that's exactly, and they're just thinking, wow, you know, this is, wow, we could really use this one right now. You know, that'll just set us up for another 100 years. But that's how these people are thinking. What the Cuba thing is just quite frankly disgusting on a level that it's very hard to even articulate. Venezuela was bad, but this idea that Cuba needs to be punished and we're going to bring freedom and love and democracy to them after we've been punishing them with a brutal embargo. Cuba's done nothing to the US. And if you're still grinding the axe of the Batista regime and the collectivization programs that came in with Castro, that was 70 years ago.
Well, how much of that is being run by our little friend there, Marco Rubio?
Well, yeah, he does have feel like he's got his little stake here. He sees himself as, you know, like he is like he's so he's got two job titles right now, National Security Advisor and Secretary of State. His
Viper
third
Latin
job is
America.
campaigning for 2028 for president. That's his third job. Footman to the Israeli lobby. There's a fourth job. Fifth job, Viceroy of Venezuela, unofficially. And sixth job is Viceroy of Cuba, the Free Republic of Cuba, presided over by Viceroy Marco Rubio.
You know, a lot of people don't know this about Marco Rubio, but the roots of his family, and he mentioned it in his speech in Spain. His family comes from that middling aristocracy in the Spanish Empire that was used actually as viceroys in the different colonies. So his ancestors were viceroys over Cuba and other areas. And he even says that, you know, they'd be shocked if they knew that the offspring of his so-and-so clan has returned and is now, reading this lecture to the Spanish government and all that. And I think in his mind, that's his aim. He quite literally wants to be the viceroy of these territories, basically the local undisputed ruler in somebody else's name, but still the local
And
undisputed ruler.
he's very friendly with the Noboa family in Ecuador, and implicated in the massive cocaine trafficking into Europe, and hidden in Noboa banana fruit packages, the Noboa fruit company, I think it's called. And then also tangential to another big cocaine trafficker, Juan Orlando Hernandez, who now we found out recently that Israel, for some reason, was very, very interested in lifting his getting him pardoned, and they put the pressure on Trump. Probably Rubio was involved in that as well, because you're talking about Israel, you're talking about Rubio, you know, you're talking about Paul Singer. Paul Singer got a nice little spiv off of the pain and suffering of the Venezuelan people by hoovering up the distressed assets of the Citgo. What the remains of Citgo, the Venezuelan state petroleum company, after the United States, through sanctioning, managed to bankrupt their foreign subsidiaries, and then Paul Singer comes in the billion, and then to get paid back from his lousy assets, the payoff was the U.S. invading and taking over Venezuela and taking control of the oil, and he positioned himself to profit off that as well. So yeah, that's how business is going right now.
But do you think Venezuela is over? I mean, look, we understand Rodriguez sold out, but then again, there's a lot of people around Rodriguez that aren't exactly happy with that. Then there's Machada and her crew that just got tossed under the bus, even after she gave her Nobel Peace Prize. She didn't earn it anyways, but at least she didn't give away the $1 million portion of it to
She
Trump.
gave it to Trump. I mean, stupidest thing. And so,
I mean, talk
yeah.
about groveling at that point. God, that's got to go up. She needs a separate prize for groveling. And then she gets tossed. She gets tossed under the bus.
Yeah, it's really bad. I don't know the extent. Craig Murray might know more than anybody, but I don't know the extent to which Delcy Rodriguez, the vice president, quote, sold out. I'm sure it was much more complicated than that sort of straightforward assessment. Because you know, that place would be crawling with CIA
Oh,
operatives
yeah, of
for
course.
decades. So I'm sure they had 100 different ways to triangulate the people in power there. But I will say that I can say it's what normally happens with these U.S. operations is they don't deliver anything after the fact. In fact, the economy will generally get worse. The wealth gap will generally increase. There'll be more corruption and pilfering, and then so that's only going to embolden the Chavista movement, and all the grassroots movements, and young socialists will catch on to the messaging of their elders, as it were, and these things tend to revitalize, like things like the Chavista movement. So I think, and that's they can't stop. You can't stop popular movements, especially when it's very clear that what was promised, you got the opposite. I mean, look at the United States. I mean, even a country that's so like anodyne and totally cucked, like America, the American political system, that they're even, you know, they're threat, they will and perhaps could threaten to overturn the fake populist revolution of MAGA with a counter revolution that's probably more more sort of tethered to reality, you could say, and the economy is a big part of that. And Trump didn't deliver. Yeah. Same with Venezuela. I can't see how they're gonna deliver. You know, the problem is even with sanctions, what happens is, and this is the thing about Venezuela. Listen, the economic, the financial department in the government of Nicolas Maduro, they took a situation of hyperinflation that was one of the worst in history. Literally, you could just burn the money. It was just spiraling out of control. Spend your paycheck by, if you got it on Friday, spend it on before Monday. Otherwise, it's going to be worthless.
Right.
So they turned that around to the point where they almost got, they got inflation down to under 10% a year at one point. Anybody that does that after being the target of economic warfare, where everything's in free fall for like 2 years, like 400, 500% inflation, to rein that in, to get it under and stable, like they deserve some kind of major award and all gold medals in like for a Nobel Prize in economics, because, and they, while they're under sanctions, while they're under embargo. I mean, so that's not an incompetent government. In my opinion, that's a very competent government. And so the U.S. was probably incensed by their comeback story in Venezuela. That's why they went in hard and heavy to take out Maduro. And they'll say, oh, Maduro was corrupt. He threw the last election. Well, you say he threw the last election. According to who? Venezuelan NGOs in New York City?
Yeah.
In Miami? Like, really show us the receipts. How did he steal the election, the last election? So that's never been made clear. The other thing is, and I don't want to get off on a, too much of a tangent, but when your country is under attack of subterfuge by NGOs, Soros, USAID, CIA, NED, plus the external manipulation of your economy, your currency, and you've got literally spooks running around everywhere in your country and causing literal riots at the border with Colombia a couple of years ago, and literally trying to destabilize your country.
Right.
If the government puts a heavy hand down at some point during elections, so what? It's within their purview to do a certain amount of that, because you're talking about stability, national stability, and stability for any government comes first. And you can audit it, you can criticize this, oh, that wasn't done right, oh, they broke procedure there, fine. But, you know, if you're in charge and you're running things, you can't just let it all go to pot, because people can die and get killed and a lot of harm can be done. So that's what the Venezuelan government did, as far as my study of that situation.
The one thing I can say that they did badly, in my opinion, is they used a lot of the money out of the oil and gas industry for the social projects, because that's why the oil and gas industry went down, because there was enough money. But on the flip side, the U.S. also banned exporting any equipment. But the real question, though, is why did they leave their reserves in the U.S.?
You know what? This is a good question. Why did they leave their gold reserves in the U.K.?
Yeah.
Because they were promised at the time. See, things have been done that nobody could have foreseen, like the abrogation of international law, the piracy, the theft. A lot of 20 years ago, it is like there was this, no matter how bad it was, that people were still going to play good cricket on certain things. and so they probably got nice return leasing their gold out to a New York bank, getting a nice little return. It's literally money for nothing. The only problem is, what happens when you ask for it back?
Yeah. The Germans found out what happens when they ask for your money back. Did Merkel ever get her whole reserves back?
I don't know.
I don't think she did.
That's a That's another one. Yeah. So, yeah, so Venezuela, same sort of boat. They're in there. That story's not over. That story's not over. I
Oh, I don't
don't
think it
think.
is. I don't think it. Let's see. When was the last time there was a full audit of Fort Knox? I think it was 1956, somewhere around there, 1958. I mean, physical, not just counting, but actually drilling, taking core samples to make sure it's actual gold all the way through, things like that. I think that was just done once in like 1958, and everybody just trusts.
Yeah. Yep. It's
And then the.
yeah, it's interesting. Ru Russia shipped quite a bit of gold. They've exported quite a bit of gold in the last couple of 6 months or so. That's
Yeah.
not that's actually, I mean, someone might look at it like, oh, that's crisis management
No.
or they're in trouble, but actually no, Russia's been steadily accumulating gold for the last 10 years and strategically, and so is China, and that's what it's for. You've
Oh,
got
yeah.
it. You use it to get things like foreign currency, or you use it to rebalance your books if your economy looks like it's a little bit on the shake. And Russia's quite adept at this. They've absolutely proven their mettle financially since 2000. I would say since 2013, Russia has shown at every single turn that they're able to engineer stability on with their economy. They've been able to balance out their domestic payments, their other obligations. And Christina Lagarde was like completely blown away by the skill of the Russian economists and Putin's finance. You could see it at the St. Petersburg Economic Forum. She's just like, yeah, almost like in awe of the financial jurisprudence of Russia. She could see, as a banker, as a major central banker, she respected them, and that says a lot.
The Russian government, there's some that's flown under the radar in the West, but the Russian government opened a market for gold, St. Petersburg stock market, strictly for physical gold, no paper on gold. And you had to bring that physical gold in. It goes into a holding bank, and within 24 hours, the purchaser gets his physical gold. And that came in last November. And I mean, gold right now is down because everybody's needing liquidity, thanks to Uncle Trump. But gold started going up because this is actual physical gold, and City of London and Wall Street have no control over making. It's absolute transparent. It's price fixing at the market level. You can see how that price is. Well, not price fixing, price discovery, that's the proper word. Meanwhile, you got price fixing in the West because everybody knows gold is well below its market value.
Yeah.
So I don't know how they respond to that one.
Yeah, I mean the per capita, Russia and China have acquired the most in gold reserves in the last 10, 15 years. And so there's a lot of, and the gold that Russia's passing to China right now, it's still staying within the BRICS world. So you just have this bigger accumulation of gold reserves between BRICS countries, between Russia and China, and so yeah, they're in a very, very strong position to back some kind of an international SDR or a currency that's backed by a basket of commodities, including gold, but not exclusively. But that's a big one if you want to talk about anchoring the trust in your money or financial system or the value of your currency, and you've got decent gold reserves, and you've got oil, and you've got other minerals, let's say. It's the ideal basket of currency. So you have the resource workhouse of the world, which is the Russian Federation. You have the manufacturing workhouse, which is China. So that creates a nice anchor for that sort of BRICS Global South constellation. Of, let's say, where the money is shifting right now, where business is shifting, where political power is shifting.
Don't forget though, and people forget this, Russia has the fourth largest manufacturing base in the world too. It's a lot smaller in China, but it's somewhere between the US and India. on the side. Russia has a very large, and I spent a lot of time in heavy manufacturing, heavy equipment, and parts because, oil, gas, services, supply chain side. And I watched a lot of these businesses go from total wrecks to looking brand new. Massive investments, upgrades, new companies opening up. So there's a large manufacturing base there.
Yeah, Russia's also very, people don't many don't know Russia's very strong in construction and building and engineering. I mean, they're the best in among the best in the world, undoubtedly.
Kerch Bridge. How many people said that thing would never exist? You can't build a bridge there, or
Oh,
it's a
that
fake
one.
bridge.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all CGI. I've been down on that bridge. It's not CGI.
But did they not build that in record
Yes.
time?
Yeah.
I mean, even from a Chinese workflow standpoint, it
Yeah.
was quick.
And it's actually two bridges, because you have the automobile bridge, and parallel you have a rail line.
That's right.
That's actually a separate bridge, separate platform, a bit lower, going down the whole length.
And it's been attacked with direct military strikes. And to my knowledge, it recovered. They managed to repair it very quickly.
It's 16 kilometers. I mean, you can't blow the whole thing up. I mean, yes, you
Yeah.
could, but it's going to take up quite a bit of effort. If you blow any one small section up, it takes about a month to repair it, bring it in. So yeah, they did. The Ukrainians did it twice. They did it with a truck bomb, and apparently that truck driver had no clue what he was driving across it. And he the second time it was I think a drone that
Yeah.
took it out from underneath. But again, they blew up one arch. Part of the bridge is closed, and yeah, they still had traffic going in the other lanes, and then they had to replace that portion.
Yeah, that isthmus and the peninsula, not on the Crimean side, but on the Russian side, that's where some of the best red wine in the world is made, by the way. It's among the best in the world. There's a few famous places there. That area is great agricultural land.
An interesting thing, before 2022, the Italians were actually buying a lot of the grape material from Russia for their wines. It's not something they advertised very often. If you looked in the right place, you'd pop up, you'd see exports to Italy, grape material, things like that, wine materials. But yeah, they were doing that. So
Yeah,
it is.
Abkhazia, that whole area, it's absolutely perfect growing conditions. Georgia, obviously, Georgia has this long and storied great agricultural and vineyard history as well.
By Georgian legend, that's all the wine came from Georgia. That was the original
Yeah.
place of wine. I don't know how much I trust that, but
In the Bible. Yeah, probably in the Bible, yeah. All the way back to biblical times.
God promised us wine here. That's why we got wine. But yeah, that's true. That's very true. And they underestimate all of it on a constant basis. Don't really hear much about it in the West.
Yeah.
Just ignore it.
So,
It'll go away.
those are things to fall back on because, infrastructure, engineering, construction, internal industries, commodities, resources. And so no matter what's happening with the fluctuations of the tumultuous global financialized overly leveraged financialized economy, those fundamentals are very much solidly in place. And it means that those countries that have those can weather the storm. Iran's one of those. Iran's one of those. China can weather the storm just by the sheer nature of their economic prowess and their massive capabilities on every front. Russia, of course, from a resource point of view, oil crisis, energy crisis, it's not going to be a domestic crisis for them per se.
Or
But
gasoline or petrol has gone up about 7 rubles. 6 rubles over this whole
yeah,
week.
and that's a crisis.
Yeah. Well, we
Yeah.
produce most of it.
There's Russians complaining about that right now. There's
Oh,
seven
yeah.
rubles. It's outrageous.
Of course, of course. And that's one of those little interesting points, because quite literally, the country can block itself off from the rest of the world, and it may not have all the high tech that it needs, but it can survive, it can feed itself, and it can continue prospering, continue building. It's got basically everything it needs.
Yeah. No, the U.S., that's the U.S., that's behind the kind of Fortress USA grand strategy thought, is that the U.S. can pull its drawbridges up, the whole world can go to hell in a handbasket, and they'll just like show up to sweep up the ashes afterwards. But the difference between the U.S. and Russia is Russia's attached to the European continent and the whole of Asia. So they're always going to have a viable export trade no matter what. So aside from the
Absolutely.
domestic economy and situation, they have constant viable clients for export. And the United States, if they make enemies with the entire world and decide to invade, attack, strangle, abuse, pillage and plunder everybody, including everybody in the Western Hemisphere, they might find problems at some point with their external trade. And I think Trump's kind of shown with the tariff wars, how some of these ill-conceived ideas of, U.S. hegemony can backfire badly.
Yeah, because Belt and Road Initiative, it's a whole job is to avoid the U.S. Navy. Go around it. But what has the U.S., the U.S., I remember the U.S. came up with lots of different theories of what they're going to, the counter Belt and Road Initiatives and things like that. But at the end of the day, what have they come up with? Well, just cause revolutions in your countries along the way. I mean, other than that, what have they got to offer the world? I'm not talking about, you had the American dream. I mean, that's dead. That's obvious to anybody in the US, that's dead. Okay, so what's your civilizational idea now? Rape and
Right. Yeah.
pillage?
What's your compelling future for the world? What are you selling? Right.
Rape and pillage? I mean,
Yeah.
that's
Punishment. All stick, no carrot.
Yeah.
You know.
Well,
I
we'll get
mean,
your owners rich, and then the rest of you peasants can go die off.
it's not a clear sales pitch right now. That's the problem. People don't understand. That's the source of U.S. power.
Yeah.
It's an idea. It's the perception of being an honest broker. The perception of being
Yeah.
a good, resourceful ally. Whether they are honest or whether they are always an ally, that's another argument. But it's that perception. Everything rests on that. And
Absolutely.
when you lose that, you lose your power. That's
Yep.
what I learned studying international relations and history, is that is really that once you lose that level of confidence, then it's just a question of time before everything begins to collapse. And I think they're in that phase now.
Hollywood is actually one of the best weapons the U.S. used to have. And
Absolutely.
Hollywood produced movies that gave you hope. Oh, look how life is great here. Everybody's cool. They're partying. They're living it up. Of course, now Hollywood just produces absolute crap that nobody wants to see, period. It's preachy, annoying, and depressing. But that Hollywood was actually that hope that they were projecting was actually a very powerful weapon. It's an
The
extremely
big, the
powerful
most
weapon.
powerful, the most, the most, I could get into it, but that, the U.S. government filmed, or they, sorry, they funded all the cinemas in France after the war
Really?
to, yes, very pro-U.S. films. And because that was, they believed that was their best shot to balance off the socialist political forces in France after the war. So this has always been a big priority, film and TV and stuff
Absolutely.
like that. And it is powerful. They stopped, but they started concentrating less on heroes and more on villains in Hollywood and dystopic, not compelling, so compelling futures. And that's what, and I think it's now just begun to fold in on itself, because it lost that magic that it was exporting. As you rightly say, it's they went dark, basically. Dark and dystopic.
They have. I mean, if you look at the movies in the 60s and the 70s, dark movies, most of them weren't that dark to begin with. But there were a lot more the Jimmy Stewart type movies that people remember. It's like, wow, yeah, I want to live like that. I want to have that house and the Christmas tree and all that. And now it's well, I mean, if you just look at the number of movies, if you look at just the number of movies that are just post-apocalyptic, I think it's like every second one. Zombies, aliens, just
Oh
constant
man, yeah, the Earth has been
society,
destroyed a
environment.
hundred times over in Hollywood. Are you talking about? But
There was even a joke. It was a Russian joke. Boy's asking his grandpa, "Grandpa, why in the American movies the aliens always attacking America?" It's like, they know where the bad guys live. That's the answer. So it's, but that's that just a reflection of society as a whole. So Patrick, I want to thank you. We got a hard stop. I got a another call coming up. I want to thank you for joining. I'd love to continue the conversation.
Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks, Stas.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you. Leave your comments and ask questions. Questions. That's the key.